Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our month-long series on solutions by talking about what we can do to take money out of politics. Every election year, political spending reaches new levels. More than $5 billion was spent on the 2018 midterms, a record-breaking amount. The most expensive Senate race in U.S. history was in Florida, with over $200 million spent. $200 million for a Senate race. Florida Governor Rick Scott, a Republican, won that race. The most expensive House race was in California's 39th district, with nearly $37 million spent. Gil Cisneros, a Democrat who ran for office for the first time, won that race. And then there's the state level. Candidates spent over $2 billion at the state level. And then we've got super PACs. Super PAC spending more than doubled from the previous midterm cycle. Groups that do not disclose their donors and shell corporations gave more than $176 million to super PACs and outside spending. Now they're called hybrid PACs. Court decisions like Citizens United, which we have been talking about for years, allow donors to give unlimited amounts of money in secret, and unidentifiable donors that funnel hundreds of millions of dollars into federal elections in recent years. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how this affects almost everything we talk about on this show and what it will take to get money out of politics. Today, we are joined by Trent Lang, Executive Director of the California Clean Money Campaign, a nonprofit working to educate Californians about the need to bring real campaign disclosure and full public financing of campaigns to California and really beyond. The organization has had a very successful 2018, prevailing on 7 out of 7 efforts against big money, including the Social Media Disclose Act. And we'll talk about those victories later in the show. Hi, Trent. Welcome to the show and congratulations on all of your victories.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very exciting and an important time. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Anna Masalia, a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics. Anna first joined the center in September 2015 and works with Open Secrets data on politically active nonprofits, non-disclosing dark money groups, and foreign influence. Hi, Anna. Thank you so much for joining us and really for all of your work, because we cite you every time we do shows about money and politics. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to hear our work has been useful.
Oh, so useful. That's where I got all the information about the most expensive Senate and House races. I mean, it's crazy to think that now it could cost up to $200 to run for a Senate race. I mean, is it $200 million to run for a Senate race?
It is. I mean, in the 2018 election cycle, we saw a number of different records broken, the most expensive Senate election ever. And the thing about those numbers especially is that the FEC or Federal Election Commission numbers only count the spending that's been reported, and there's so much else out there that is just more secretive political group spending, and we don't even know how much else doesn't get reported. And so those numbers are just really striking.
Right. I mean, $200 million for a Senate race and then $37 million for a House race. And both of these guys, Rick Scott and Gil Cisneros, who's actually a lottery winner, spent millions of their own money on these races. And so that's another problem, because an average citizen really can't run. I mean, unless you have massive name recognition like Bernie Sanders to get small donations. But I want to ask you both a pretty basic question. Can you talk about just the effect that all of this has? Because over the years, so many studies have shown that because of money and politics, the wealthy few move policies, while average citizens have very little power when it comes to big policy decisions. So, Anna, can you take that one first?
Sure. One of the reasons that we think it's so important to know who's actually behind political spending, whether that be outside groups or big donors, is because we want to empower the voters. It's so important to know where that messaging is coming from and where it's being colored by. Oftentimes, you'll see messages on the news. You'll see message or different types of ads online, and it's so important to know what interests are actually behind that so that you can take that into account, because that's the information that voters are taking to the polls with them.
And what would you add, Trent? The big question about just really how this affects policies and our everyday lives.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, because the policies that a government passes reflects the people that are most responsible and wealthy interests that are most responsible for getting people elected. They have kind of no choice but to do that. The current system requires candidates to raise outrageous sums of money, and then so much of that money is raised in the dark, so people don't even know what's happening. So it biases our politics and policies towards a wealthy interest rather than regular Americans, and I think it also makes so many people feel shut out of the process that they don't even engage, and that's really dangerous for our democracy as well.
So let's talk about what has really changed since the Citizens United decision, which came down 9 years ago. Anna, the Center for Responsive Politics has so many articles about how spending has really changed. And so what you see is individual donors who are incredibly wealthy are giving so much money to parties. Sheldon Adelson is at the top of the list. He is the conservative Republican casino magnate. According to all of your data, he gave $123 million to Republicans just in the 2018 election cycle. So can you talk a little bit about what has really changed since Citizens United and how it's really empowered one individual to have so much influence on politics?
Well, since Citizens United, we've seen just a proliferation of outside groups spending in elections. It's no longer just the candidate, their campaign, and the voters. There's super PACs, there's 501c4s, there's a variety of other types of groups that are popping up now. And I think that that's really the big thing we've seen change. We've seen dark money groups, which typically 501c4 nonprofit organizations that hold themselves out as kind of advocacy groups spending in elections. We're seeing them spend millions and millions of dollars, in some cases just supporting a single candidate, and in some cases even disappearing after doing that, and without ever having disclosed their donors. We're seeing just a huge increase in that since Citizens United. We're also seeing these types of groups continue to get smarter and continue to invent new tactics to avoid disclosure and to funnel more money in politics without having to disclose their donors in many cases, or without having to, in some cases, disclose their finances at all. That's something that we've seen a lot through the 2018 election. In addition to just solely non-disclosing groups, one of the things that's been really interesting to follow this election cycle was the partially disclosing groups, groups that do disclose their donors to the Federal Election Commission, but may either only disclose some of their donors or disclose non-disclosing groups. What that would be, for example, would be a super PAC that is funded by a dark money group, and we're seeing a huge increase in those. For instance, since Citizens United, we've seen about $800 million in spending by non-disclosing groups. Just this election cycle, we saw $405 million by partially disclosing groups as of our last tally, and it's just a huge amount of money that is going largely unaccounted for.
Trent, when we were putting the show together, I was reminded of a piece in the New York Times back in October 2015 called Just 158 Families Have Provided Nearly Half of the Early Money for Efforts to Capture the White House. So in order to really uncover this dark money, you have to really dig. I mean, a lot of the reporters that we have on say it's becoming harder and harder, but you have to put a team of reporters on this, which the New York Times did. They found that these families are overwhelmingly white, rich, older, and male, the people who gave to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So what are your thoughts about what's really changed from Citizens United?
I think you've put your finger on it a little bit in the studies from the Center for Responsive Politics, just showing the absolute dominance at some level of those 158 families in directing who can get elected, And it's especially bad when they do it in secret behind these dark money groups that hide behind layers of groups, not just behind super PACs that don't report nearly often enough, but then behind these 501c4 groups where they don't even have to report at all. So it's almost impossible in many cases nationally to get behind who the funders are, and it's very dangerous because I guarantee you the politicians that benefit, they're made known who's helping them, but the public doesn't know who's helping, who's influencing the system, and even where these messages are coming from. So we absolutely have to shine a bright light on that, get that funding out into the open so people can really see who's trying to influence and buy their votes.
And in the case of the 158 families exposed by the New York Times, 138 of those families gave to Republicans. 20 of those families gave to Democrats. So that's a major, significant difference between who gave to Republicans and Democrats. Anna, when we did shows about the 2018 election, the Democrats really caught up to the Republicans. But when you look at big, big money, and we're talking about, because there's a big difference between the Kochs and Tom Steyer. A lot in the media like to say, well, you've got the Kochs on the right and Tom Steyer on the left. But there's a big difference between why they're giving money and what their end goal is. So when you look at who actually gives massive amounts of money, what strikes you about how they spend it and who they give it to?
I think the differences in disclosure levels is one thing we've seen. We've seen a huge shift, as you kind of hit the nail on the head there, with more Democrats spending in general, but also more Democrats, strangely enough, spending on dark money. In this election cycle, probably the top group that was spending was Majority Forward, which was a Democrat group, or a group supporting Democrats, and that was a 501c4. We're seeing them spending millions of dollars, but there is a lot to catch up on. That's not saying that the groups spending on the right are spending any less these days. It's just that the Democratic groups have a lot to catch up on. In terms of the big donors, we do see varying levels of disclosures. You mentioned Tom Steyer. A lot of his spending, at least as of recent, has been disclosed. Even in his digital ads, you're seeing a little paid for by Tom Steyer disclaimer in some of the ads as he really ramps up his image. Whereas the Kochs have a much quieter involvement in a lot of their groups. And even in the case of the Koch brothers, they don't necessarily show up on our list of top political donors near the top of the list because a lot of their spending is on 501c4s, 501c3s, and other kind of advocacy groups that don't necessarily disclose their donors. And so you're not seeing them in the FEC reports as often as you would someone like Tom Steyer, who has super PACs and who really does put his name out there. So I think that that's another big difference. I don't think that that's necessarily the case anymore for all left-leaning donors. Since you do have groups like Majority Forward, you also have a variety of different tactics that have been deployed on the left that do skirt disclosure. We were seeing a lot of pop-up super PACs this election cycle. That was something that we've seen used by both parties, but in particular this election cycle by party-tied Democrat groups. What I'm meaning by pop-up PACs in this case is super PACs that kind of pop up or just start to exist very close to the election cycle in a way that gains the deadlines for FEC filings and don't end up having to disclose their donors until after the election. And in multiple cases this election cycle, that turned out to be Democratic Party-aligned groups. And so we're seeing them embrace dark money in a way that we haven't before. And while still, in many cases, the rhetoric of the candidates is decrying that same dark money, even candidates who are supported by it. So it's an interesting dichotomy there.
Well, and let's talk about how to tackle that issue specifically, Anna, because, like you said, a lot of these Democrats decry dark money and taking big money, when you're running for office and you hear that in Florida it costs $200 million to win a Senate race and Governor Rick Scott did not win by much, it was 0.08%, and then a House race in California, $37 million, What are the alternatives? Because, you know, the New York Times had a great piece, but a really just frustrating piece about how Michael Bloomberg spent $400,000 just in advertising in Oklahoma City for Kendra Horn, a House Democrat. He spent so much money in places across the country to prop up Democrats, and a lot of them won. He spent $41 million on 24 House races. And the argument of these Dems would be, but look, we've got the Republicans spending all this money, and so how do I get my message out there? I have no choice but to have Bloomberg put TV ads on to let people know that I'm running. So when you're looking at these House and Senate races, what are the solutions at that level to get this massive, these massive amounts of money out of politics?
Well, we're seeing a few different tactics being used in lieu of having big billionaire backers or dark money. In some cases, we're seeing candidates revert to a lot of digital advertising. It's one of the newer ways to spend less and have a much bigger impact than you could in more traditional settings, with things like political ads on TV or radio broadcasts. In many cases, these do cost big dollars for production value, that type of thing, whereas there are alternatives now through digital advertising, social media, that candidates are starting to resort to, that outside groups even are starting to resort to, that have, it's very early in the process, but shown to be pretty effective in some cases for grassroots organizing. We're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing candidates increasingly like using those directly to reach voters, to actually give them a voice. And I think that's a really interesting tactic. We've only recently been able to start tracking that, though, because a lot of the digital ad platforms and social media platforms like Facebook, Google, Twitter didn't release a lot of their data until earlier this year. So we really don't know how much that was relied on in previous years. FEC data shows that digital spending in general, so it's kind of digital services, not just digital advertising, but related services, has increased substantially over the last few years. And so in turn, we're seeing more digital advertising. And I think that that's certainly one way for candidates who are not well funded to be able to kind of have a bigger impact from their messaging that we've seen, at least during the 2018 election cycle. It'll be interesting to see how that gets used going into 2020 as well, since we've seen a lot of the presidential hopefuls also relying on this platform.
Well, I'm afraid that that's probably going to break records again, because Donald Trump has already raised an unprecedented $100 million for his reelection bid. I mean, this is an unprecedented number 2 years before the election. Well, now just about a year and a half. Trent, I know that you focused specifically.
From day one, we saw that with.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Anna.
Sorry. From day one, we saw that with Trump registering to be a federal candidate on the day of his inauguration. He submitted the paperwork to the FEC, and that is unheard of for presidential candidates.
Trent, we're going to talk about what's happening in California right after the break, but I just wanted to ask you, when you look at just how expensive it is now to run for the Senate and the House, what solutions would you like to see? I mean, is overturning Citizens United at the top of your list? Is that one way to really take money out of politics at the federal levels?
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, we have to overturn Citizens United because it unleashed that all those funds, but we can't wait for that. That's hard to do. It'll probably take a constitutional amendment to do so, unless the Supreme Court has a substantial change that is not super likely at the moment. But there is a lot that we can do, even under Citizens United, to dramatically increase disclosure, so people know who's trying to buy elections, to provide for public financing of campaigns so that candidates can compete more on a level playing field, can really have a chance to go. So there's lots of things that we can do that we're starting to model here in California, and things that are spreading around the nation. So there's promise, but we got to really work at it.
Is this even possible? Could we ever have a regulation or some kind of law that says if you run for Senate, there's a cap on what you can spend or raise, say $5 million instead of $200 million? Or is that just a dream?
That would almost certainly take a constitutional amendment. Supreme Court decisions previous to Citizens United said that you could put limits on how much candidates could accept as contributions from individual people. That's why at the federal level there's a $2,700 contribution limit for congressional and presidential candidates, although that increases with inflation. But the Supreme Court even before said you can't put up mandatory spending limits. You can't only say the most you can spend is X million dollars. On the other hand, if you have candidates that voluntarily participate in public financing systems, as we have in places like Arizona and Maine and Connecticut and a growing number of cities, those candidates that voluntarily participate can be required to abide by spending limits if they're going to accept the public monies, which is actually one of the best benefits of public financing systems. That is a way to put a cap in it. If you develop a system that gives candidates enough public funds to run competitive campaigns without having to raise money from big special interests, that's a way that you can do that. And you see in states like Connecticut and Maine, 70-80% plus of the legislature actually using the public financing and therefore accepting those limits and not accepting special interest money.
Can you give us a quick example of how that's worked? This is starting to get more attention. And voters, I mean, when you look at the numbers, overwhelming majorities of the population want to get money out of politics. So give us an example of what you see as a success story. And I'm assuming that those are state offices, is that right?
Yes. So in Maine, Connecticut, and also Arizona to a slightly lesser extent, they have clean election styles where public financing systems where candidates have to prove that they're viable by getting a large number of small contributions, typically $5 from their constituents. Then when they qualify, then they get a chunk of public funds, a set chunk that's enough to run a competitive campaign. And then they don't have to do any more fundraising at all. This is extremely attractive to candidates and voters because the candidates can literally say, I'm not bought by anybody. I'm using all of my funds from small donors and from the public financing system. That's why you see candidates be able to get out of the fundraising game in places like Maine and Connecticut. 70-80% of them, not raising special interest money. I think that's a success. There are still additional things that have to be done because the system isn't fully comprehensive. There are some candidates who may look and say, well, I want to run for Congress someday so I'm going to need to keep raising funds in certain ways. So it's not perfect, but it's really made a big difference. Another very exciting a proposal I think that's been happening is the city of Seattle has passed a voucher system where they actually give every Seattle resident $425 vouchers that they can give to the candidate of their choice. And so candidates, rather than accepting big money checks, get those $25 vouchers from their constituents, if their constituents believe in them, and that stops the candidates from raising special interest money, it gets the voters really engaged in the process. And there in Seattle, we've seen that a significant majority of the candidates who've run using that voucher public financing system have succeeded and gotten out of the big money game. So there are several different exciting approaches that are happening and being considered.
Well, after the break, we'll talk about more of these changes that are happening across the country to get money out of politics. That is Trent Lang, Executive Director of the California Clean Money Campaign. We're also joined today by Anna Mosalia, researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics. Today, we're talking about what it will take to get money out of politics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our series on solutions by talking about what real criminal justice reform would look like. We'll talk about the First Step Act, which is a bipartisan bill that was signed into law at the end of the year. Activists say that is just a start. So we'll talk about that bill and other needed reforms. Earlier this week, we talked about the Green New Deal and universal health care, and you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about what it will take to get money out of politics, we keep seeing new levels of money being spent. More than $5 billion was spent on the 2018 midterm elections. And the population, according to so many polls, overwhelming majorities want money out of politics. So what questions do you have? What kind of changes would you like to see? If anything really struck you about this last election in your area, we'd love to hear from you. The one thing that struck me in California, just the ballot initiative spending is off the charts. Again, we broke records. Here in California, dialysis companies spent a whopping $111 million to fight Proposition H, which would have limited their profits, and it did lose. How could it not, with $111 million on TV ads? So if anything stood out for you in your area, give us a call. And what changes would you like to see to tackle that specific issue? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Anna Mosalia, researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics. She works specifically on politically active nonprofits, non-disclosing dark money groups, and foreign influence. And they do incredible work following the money. We're also joined by Trent Lang, executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. They had a great 2018, prevailing on 7 out of 7 efforts against big money. Trent, we were talking about some successful new laws across the country, especially public financing. There's a great piece over at campaignlegal.org, and they pointed out that 3 major cities, Baltimore, Denver, and Washington, D.C., adopted legislation to create new public financing programs for candidates and municipal elections. In fact, in Prince George County, Maryland, 70% of voters wanted to provide candidates with matching funds for local campaign donations. So this is really taking off across the country.
Yeah, I think that people are really waking up to the absolute need to get big money out of politics, but not only to just generally get money, big money out of politics, but to provide solutions that boost small donors. So it was really exciting to see those 70% plus wins in places like Denver and Baltimore to provide an alternative. Without a constitutional amendment, it will be very difficult to stop unlimited contribution with unlimited contributions from coming into campaigns, but we can make sure that good candidates with good ideas have an alternative, so they're not chasing after big money, so that small donors can really be boosted. We've seen a lot of that. Bernie Sanders, certainly in his campaign, presidential campaign, really put a major focus on the need to stop the 1% from dominating our politics with their campaign contributions. He and other candidates since then have kind of ushered in an era where, at least in some cases, candidates are able to really compete just by using small donations, which is really fabulous. That is can provide a little a significant counterweight, but we absolutely need to provide more to really boost small donors. The passage of some of these new laws is showing the hunger for that. So if you have that on top of real disclosure increases, then I think we've got a fighting chance. But we're going to have to really fight, because those big money special interests who have so much control are not going to make it easy.
You're right. Anna, do you have anything to add on publicly financed campaigns? Anna?
Well, we've certainly seen a rise in that over the country. We don't take a position other than the increase in transparency. A lot of those bills have been coupled with those types of provisions, so I think that's certainly been a step in the right direction, but we don't really take a stance on that.
All right. Well, it is growing across the country. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
thank you very much. I'll keep my comment very, very short. We used to have a thing I think was called equal time, where it was standard practice for candidates in major competitions for office. Both had equal amounts of time to make their point. And I see no reason why we couldn't retreat to that forum method for forum, so that people could have their voices heard in an honest and open way. Full disclosure, yes, of course. And then finally, although we used to do that, when I say the equal time, with broadcast media, television, and so forth, I see no reason why that couldn't be associated even on radio and print, where, if we want to go as far as this, give the opportunity for for organizations who are not willing to allow public voices to be heard, that their license could be pulled. You know, make it part of our society that voices be heard on an equal basis. That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, I love this idea. And Howard wrote in with a similar question. Since the public owns the airwaves, can we forbid broadcasters from charging for political ads and at the same time restore the idea of equal time? If TV ads were free, politicians would not need to raise so much money. And after all, Trump received the equivalent of hundreds of millions in campaign donations in the form of airtime. Oh, he definitely did. In fact, I was reading about this last night. Trump received $5 billion in free media, according to the media analysis firm MediaQuaint. And what about this, Trent? I mean, it would be so amazing if we could get equal time for candidates. The problem is, with all of the cable shows making so much money, how do you even go about that? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in ads that these candidates spend.
Yeah, we absolutely need to have more equal time. We used to have the fairness doctrine that required that. I mean, it's fundamentally not a fair and equal democracy if some candidates have dramatically more access to time, to advertising, to airtime than others. People need to hear kind of equally from both sides. So that's a real challenge. I don't think there's any, you know, the Congress should consider going back to the fairness doctrine. It's a little bit more complicated now, because back when that was repealed in 1987, most broadcasts were over the air, and now you have cable and you have internet broadcasts, so the control issues aren't quite as easy to necessarily resolve. But it's something that should be looked into, absolutely. But what we can do for sure, even absent that, is to work on things like public financing of campaigns and real disclosure, like in the Disclose Act, so that you can make it more fair in the system and make sure that people really understand who is trying to buy their elections.
Right. Well, thank you for the email and the phone call. We will definitely continue to follow more of this and maybe even do a show about the fairness doctrine, because that's a really important one. We have an email from Eileen. She says, thanks for the show. You could think of campaign finance reform as helping our Congress critters, because they spend, what is it, one day every week dialing for dollars, begging for donations, when they could be doing the business of government. Anna, do you know, I've read in some books that there are these, it's like a call center. It actually looks like a call center, and that's where politicians go to call big donors to ask them for money. You know, how much time do you know does the average politician in D.C. spend on the phone asking for money?
Well, I don't have any data on the average time, but I've certainly seen testimonies from former members of Congress and former senators saying that that type of thing does exist. And I think that that presents real challenges to actually getting legislative work done. If members of Congress and senators are spending their time making calls trying to fundraise instead of actually doing their job, I think that that's a huge issue that needs to be addressed.
Trent, what does that look like at the state level?
It's very similar. I mean, the state elections, legislative elections, cost minimum of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, in many cases multi-million dollars. So legislators are constantly dialing for dollars, and then They are having to spend a lot of time in fundraisers. Every legislative session in August, it's just jam-packed, all the fundraisers hosted by lobbyists right across the street from the Capitol, and the legislators just have to stream out and go to those fundraisers to raise the money that they need to compete. It really is destructive to our system. It stops them from spending time doing the jobs that they really need to focus on, and it gives an incredibly biased perspective to them, because I don't necessarily think that a lot of politicians are necessarily bought per se, but it dramatically influences who has access to politicians. So if they're spending all their time talking to wealthy interest and well-spoken lobbyists who have good arguments for why they should act in one policy way or another, and they simply do not have time, and literally they just do not have time in many cases to actually speak with their regular constituents significantly, or much less good government groups or public interest groups that don't have the time or the money to give that don't have the money to attend those meetings. It really biases what happens. So we got to get politicians out of the fundraising game. Absolutely.
Well, let's spend some time really talking about more solutions. Again, Trent, your organization had a very successful 2018, prevailing on 7 out of 7 efforts against big money. That's an amazing accomplishment. Which ones were you most excited about? Because we can't talk about all 7, unfortunately.
The biggest thing, I think, especially as to this issue, was 2 years ago, we passed the California Disclose Act, and last year we followed up with the Social Media Disclose Act. So looking at all of those ads that use secret money, that have used secret money and nationally still use secret money, that use misleading names if they have disclosures at all. You know, they'll say paid for by Stop Hidden Taxes or Californians for a Healthy Government, et cetera, rather than showing the true funders. What we were able to pass with a tremendous coalition and grassroots campaign and the leadership of authors like Assembly Speaker Pro Tem Kevin Mullen, who authored both of those 2 Disclose Act bills, was to require in California for the first time anywhere, and we hope this will be a model for everywhere else, that political ads for and against ballot measures and for and against candidates by outside groups and super PACs must clearly show on the bottom one-third of the screen on a solid black background the names of the top 3 funders that actually paid for the ad that are running this campaign, so that if you don't see Stop Hidden Taxes, as is one example that we use. Instead, you see that the true funders in that case were Chevron, Philip Morris, and Anheuser-Busch. A very, wow, very big difference. And another key part of these Disclose Act bills that, again, we hope will be a model, and looks like there's evidence of that happening already, even at the national level, is kind of peeling the onion going back, so that if they do, as Anna said, and try to hide behind another dark money nonprofit or even just other super PACs, that you have to show the true funders on the ads and not just, you know, the name of another Californians for Healthy Children as one of the top funders. So that took a 7-year campaign that was a huge grassroots campaign. Hundreds of thousands of petitions, 350 endorsing organizations that came behind it, people making thousands of phone calls and packing committee hearings and all that. We were finally able to get that into place in California. That was actually in effect in our last election. So California ballot measures and super PAC ads had to show those top 3 funders. And now we're looking at having to expand it, because there are so many ways that secret money does buy elections. The Social Media Disclose Act last year, we expanded that to ads on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Google, so that they have to show the top 3 funders of those ads as well, because we've seen the huge problems that they have. So that's what we did last year, and this year we're working on a couple of other exciting new bills, like the Petition Disclosure Act and the Issue Ads Disclose Act.
And the California Disclose Act, again, just one more question on this. This is fantastic that these ballot measure ads have to clearly disclose their top three true funders. So like you said, it can't just be, we love kids. It has to be, who's actually, I mean, this is, I bet there's a group out there called that.
Yes.
The groups that actually fund those organizations. And where will those names be? Because, you know, in California, we are bombarded with TV ads and mailers. So where will those names actually be?
They, in the California Disclose Act that passed, they have to be on all the television ads. They have to be on all the radio ads. They have to be on all of the print ads as well. And robocalls, too. Those robocalls have to show, list their top two funders. And then with the passage of AB 2188, the Social Media Disclose Act last year, that's now been extended to ads on Facebook and Twitter and Google. So it's already making a tremendous difference here in California. Now we need to keep extending it to different areas in California, but also have other states in the country follow this model so that national campaigns, because unfortunately California law, we can't even affect ads for or against Congress members. We can just do legislative and gubernatorial candidates and so forth. So it does need to expand nationally. But I think it's a very exciting model. It was a huge, huge battle against the powerful interests that didn't want this change. There's no doubt about that. But we were able to get it done because the grassroots, the people really demanded it.
How will this be enforced, Trent?
In California, we have a very strong enforcement organization, the Fair Political Practices Commission, that actually does the enforcement. They are empowered to even subpoena groups' records if need be. So in California, that's the way it is enforced. You have citizens can, of course, watch, and if they see there's a violation, they can report it to the FPPC. The FPPC has the ability to provide fines of up to three times the cost of the ad, so potentially millions of dollars, if there are intentional violations or violations of the top three funder requirement. So there's pretty good enforcement. That sort of enforcement would also need to be modeled in other places. At the national level, the FEC is unfortunately not as effective at the moment. But in California, we have good models.
Anna, let's say this takes off across the country. How does disclosure affect funding? Do you know?
How does disclosure affect funding?
Yes. So, if, for example, if there's a ballot initiative in California and the top three donors know that they're going to be on every single ad, does that affect how much they spend?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of research on that, but I think it can go multiple different ways. You have some donors who really don't want their names tied to certain initiatives, potentially due to repercussions with their businesses, with their personal life, with any other types of endeavors they're getting into. But then you also have people who really like having their name out there and want to use that either just because they believe in transparency or for more strategic purposes, to get their name out there, to develop a political brand, to develop a personal brand, to develop a business or corporate brand. And so you're seeing kind of both ways. I think that putting those out there could even encourage some donors to donate because they are going to have their names showing up on TV. Whereas in the cases of some donors, I think that it might discourage them. I think it could go both ways.
Go both ways. We have a tweet from TJ, who's listening in Montana online. Hi, TJ. He says that they broke a spending record to defeat a tobacco tax Medicaid expansion ballot measure. He writes, I wish ballot measure committees were part of the discussion when it comes to public financing debates. What about this one, Trent? What are your thoughts about spending on ballot measures here in California? And again, possibly this could take off across the country. Talk a little bit about how you're trying to affect spending on ballot measures.
That's a great question, and that is something that we've really seen just everywhere, is that good ballot measures can be completely swamped by tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars in places like California by outside spending. So I think the the Disclose Act with the real requirements to show the top three funders will make a big difference. So at least people are not fooled by who the actual messenger is. That can really make a big difference. I do think that we should consider different possible ways of doing at least some form of public financing, even for ballot measures, because they're going to dramatically affect our government. I mean, it's so much in states like California and Montana and Washington are decided. People's lives are decided about the passage or not passage of different ballot measures. So some public financing would be very well worth it. It's a possibility. You could say a voucher system like in Seattle, where each person has is given $100 in credits that they can give to the candidate of their choice. Maybe they should be allowed to give to the ballot measure of their choice up to the amount that they're allowed to give, something like that. You could have some creative solutions. That hasn't been done anywhere yet, but I could see that as a way to at least make sure that each ballot side has as a little bit fairer balance of resources, and that people can actually provide support and influence towards the ones that they like.
Hmm. Well, since you're in Montana, there's a great documentary, maybe you've seen it, called Dark Money, that looks at how people in Montana fought against people with massive amounts of money. It's a fantastic documentary, and all the activists in Montana are doing great work there. Let's take a few calls, and then we'll get responses from Trent Lang, Executive Director of the California Clean Money Campaign. And we're also joined today by Anna Masalia, a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rose. I'm wondering about whether media outlets, television in particular, will tend to cover a candidate if there's more money in it for them, because there's more attention in it for them. There's more viewership if they cover that candidate, and that's their reason for covering that candidate, for example, Trump. And I wonder if that snowballs that reason for coverage.
All right, thank you. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go to Nancy in San Francisco. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, this is Nancy Neff in Palo Alto, and I just wanted to say I'm a coordinator with the California Clean Money Campaign here. I'm a volunteer. And so many people have been really buoyed by the success of the progress of clean money in California. And can you talk about how regular people can get involved?
Yes, great question. Thank you, Nancy. We'll take one more call, and then we'll get responses. Craig in San Jose. Hi, Craig.
Hi. Yes, I'm curious about things. I understand San Francisco is working on an open source paper ballot voting system, and I'm wondering if your guest could say something about that.
Yes, we're actually going to do a show about paper ballots. Thank you. Let's first take Mark's question. What are your thoughts about this, Anna? Just about, you know, candidates that bring in more money for television. I mean, we've talked about this many times over the years, but Les Moonves, well, now he was kicked out of CBS because of sexual harassment claims. But Les Moonves, making over $60 million a year at CBS, telling an investor group, you know, go Donald, go. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. I mean, you saw him on MSNBC every single day during the primaries. So what about that? Just quick response, Anna.
I think we're really just trying to grapple with the huge effect of earned media on political success. It's not something that we've seen to this extent before, where you have the ability to leverage that type of celebrity. To some extent, we saw it in earlier presidential elections, but really now the pervasiveness of TV and even the pervasiveness of digital media has had a huge impact based on earned media, and it makes it harder to quantify how much candidates are actually benefiting from either news media groups, digital outlets, even news online, and because they are, in many cases, the candidates who are more clickbaity or who have the more exciting message are the ones who are getting more media rather than the candidates who are trying to catapult themselves based on their own viewpoints and what they're actually running on. And so I think that's something that we really need to figure out a way to quantify and how to handle it going forward.
Right. And already Democratic candidates, potential candidates, are being interviewed. And I really hope they talk about issues. But so far, it's really been about personality and, you know, things like impeachment. So hopefully we'll see actual issues being discussed. Nancy wanted to know, how can people get involved in these campaigns? I mean, Trent, since you all at the California Clean Money Campaign were so successful, you prevailed on 7 out of 7 efforts. It took you 7 years to get the Disclose Act, but you did it. I mean, how did you do it? What would you say to people in other states who are wanting to also work on and pass these laws?
I would say our lesson is get involved and work together. One of the things that led to our success was here in California was a giant coalition of all sorts of allied groups, not only groups like Common Cause and League of Women Voters that we normally work with, but all sorts of groups. And then it's partially signing those petitions, but get involved beyond signing petitions and making a single call to your Congress member. We succeeded at California Clean Money Campaign on the Disclose Act by getting people involved, going out to women's marches and gathering signatures on petitions for the Disclose Act. In fact, people are going to be doing that at the women's marches in a couple of weekends from now. Getting involved doing phone banking to call supporters in an organized sort of campaign. Help go to hearings in Sacramento or to your legislator, your city council when something's coming up. It really makes a difference when politicians see the people are behind something. It really pays off.
Well, thank you for that. And we don't have time. I'm sorry that we don't have time to talk about paper ballots, Craig, but we're definitely going to do a show about that. So thank you so much for all the phone calls. Trent Lang is executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign, and you can find out about all of the great work that they have been doing to pass legislation, including the Social Media Disclose Act. We've also been joined by Anna Massalia, researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics, and they do an amazing job of following the money. Trent and Anna, thank you for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our month-long series on solutions by talking about what real criminal justice reform would actually look like. We'll talk about the First Step Act, which was signed last year. Activists say it's just a start, so we'll talk about that bill and other needed reforms. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.